Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, as the Syrian situation continues to get complicated, we'll explore how the relationships and regional dimensions can help to resolve the conflict. Then, when should the international community intervene on atrocities? What does international law say about intervention? What about U.S. law? Negotiations continue to become more complex over the Syrian conflict. Both Russia and the U.S. have been building naval forces in the Mediterranean Sea, according to The Guardian, while Syria has reportedly been scattering chemical weapons to multiple locations, according to The Wall Street Journal. Meanwhile, the United Nations has accused the Syrian government forces of systematically attacking hospitals and medical staff and using hospitals as torture centers. Human Rights Watch has also issued a report that details an overlooked massacre by Bashar al-Assad's forces that killed 248 people in two villages. Many were women and children. Given the complexities of the international relationships and the potential effects of an escalated conflict, can the regional and international communities be harnessed to resolve the conflict? Chris Mani is the deputy director at the New Zealand Center for Human Rights, Law, Policy, and Practice, and on the Faculty of Law at Auckland University. He is the author of The Justice Sector Afterthought, Witness Protection in Africa, Pretoria, and the book chapter, Prioritizing International Sex Crimes Before the Special Court for Sierra Leone, Another Instrument of Political Manipulation. Eric Bordenkircher also joins us. He is a doctoral candidate in Islamic Studies at UCLA. His papers include Islamists in a Pluralist Society. Welcome, Eric Bordenkircher, and welcome, Chris Mani. It's great to have the two of you with us. And Chris, it's great to have you back with us. I thought we should perhaps start with what the regional ramifications are of, first of all, what's going on in Syria with the conflict, but also what the regional implications are of intervention. Eric Bordenkircher, you've been studying that region. What's your take?
Well, there's been intervention going on in this conflict almost from the moment it began, through the Qataris, Saudis, the Turkish government, mostly through financial means, but also through weapons. Hezbollah in Lebanon has entered the conflict back in, I believe, May of this year. And the Iranian regime, from what I understand, also has been intervening with troops as well. So there's been intervention that has been occurring for some time now. I guess the question becomes whether the United States or Western countries, particularly NATO, would intervene at this point, and then that becomes an issue of how big a strike or how profound the intervention would be.
You said that some of it's been financial, but some of it's already been militarily intervening. Who is doing which part from the regional actors?
The Qataris and the Saudis, for the most part, are supporting the opposition to the Syrian regime, while Hezbollah and the Iranian regime is attempting to prop up the Syrian regime. And this intervention is basically a microcosm of the polarity that exists in the region at the moment between Iran and Saudi Arabia, or this kind of Sunni-Shia divide. And the United States, for the most part, has fallen on the side of the Saudis and the Qataris.
Let's bring Chris Mani in. Chris Mani, you've also been writing about this. Now, your expertise is in human rights, and you've been studying the entire human rights regime for quite a while. How do you see this?
On the intervention side, it's difficult to make a case for intervention under international law. There are really two ways in which one state can attack another, and that's if one state is there's an imminent threat, so that's the self-defense doctrine. Then there is the circumstance in which the United Nations Security Council authorizes force. And, of course, that's not the case in the situation with Syria. And then there are some that advance this theory of humanitarian intervention, which is very weak in international law. I think most scholars agree that it's not a legal basis for intervention. And so there really is no legal justification for a U.S. or NATO or otherwise Western allied attack on Syria. That makes it particularly difficult for the Saudi-Qatari alliance that we've just been speaking to, because it appears as though the rebels in Syria are in particular enthusiastic about procuring some kind of attack from the United States, and certainly the leadership has been encouraging it, because over the last few months it appears as though they are on the run to some extent. They're losing this conflict. And so the Saudi-Qatari side appears to be losing this regional-type conflict that my colleagues just been speaking to.
Chris Mani, you also wrote about the kind of bigger picture of this when you did that piece in The Atlantic about how the various interests are lining up. Could you lay that out the way you see it?
Russia is, of course, far more deeply engaged.
And why? And why is Russia so engaged? What are its interests?
First of all, Russia has a long-standing relationship with the Assad government. Russia has its only naval base outside the former Soviet Union in Syria. It's on the Mediterranean Sea, so strategically that's particularly important for Russia. There's also the fact that the Qataris wish to build a pipeline, a gas pipeline across Syria that could potentially supply Europe. And that would, of course, compete with Russia's predominant position in supplying Europe with gas. Then there is the fact that Russia has a commercial relationship with Syria. So Russia sells arms to Syria. There's a significant Russian expatriate population within Syria. And Syria is also, I guess, an expression of Russia's influence within the Middle East. Syria has a long-standing relationship with Iran, as the other speakers already pointed out, and that exaggerates Russia's influence within the Middle East as well. So to lose Syria would be a significant dilution of Russia's influence within the Middle East and a significant encroachment into Russia's influence on the part of the United States, on the part of Saudi Arabia, and on the part of Qatar, this competing alliance. There are all sorts of rumors about Prince Bandar, who was allegedly coordinating a lot of the support for the rebels, attempting to coerce Putin to give up Assad in a meeting he held with him recently.
The Guardian newspaper is saying that while the diplomats are talking, both the U.S. and Russia were building naval forces in the Mediterranean. Russia's dispatched a carrier killer, was what they called it, missile cruiser, and other ships. What do you make of this?
It's a significant buildup, of course. You also have the deployment of forces and weaponry along the Turkish-Syrian border on the part of the U.S. So there's obviously a significant buildup. Now, China has a long-held position of respect for territorial sovereignty. So it has basically stayed back. So if you look at the five permanent members of the Security Council, China is really playing no practical role here other than to provide diplomatic support for Russia at the Security Council. So those that take an even wider view may say China is taking a back seat, adopting a watch-and-smile approach, as potentially the United States, along with France and the UK, may be drawn into conflict. Of course, the likelihood of the UK participating militarily is now significantly diminished after the vote in Parliament. But, of course, Russia would then have to expend significant resources to support the Syrian government. And after Iraq, after the trillions of dollars spent on Iraq and Afghanistan, it has significantly affected the fiscal position of the United States, as well as, of course, the capacity of so many of those deployed militarily to return to the United States economy and contribute as a consequence of either physical or psychological disablement. So China sees itself as simply taking a step back, focusing on growing its own economy and its own power in the medium to long term. And it's difficult to see, even from a very self-interested point of view for the United States, just whether this is really worth the potential benefits in terms of influence within the Middle East. If you consider where the United States to get militarily engaged, the cost, both in economic and human terms, if the U.S. gets drawn into this. And of course, they're saying there won't be any boots on the ground, but nonetheless, it's still very expensive to deploy, you know, to deploy these naval forces and these ground armaments to provide weapons to the armed opposition, as we now know they're doing. But there's also the proxy provision of support. So we recently had the announcement by the Department of Defense stating that they're about to provide, I think it's around $10 billion in support to Saudi Arabia. And of course, Saudi Arabia, as my colleagues just noted, is supporting the rebels. But Saudi Arabia has also pledged around $12 billion to the Egyptian military. So when the United States is providing this level of support to Saudi Arabia, and then Saudi Arabia is providing support within the region, it undermines not just the U.S. position of stating, well, we don't want to go above and beyond provision of any particular weapons in Syria, but it also undermines the U.S. position to some extent with regard to, I think, around the $1.3 billion it says it's holding on to in the meantime whilst it observes events in Egypt.
Eric Bordenkercher, let's bring you back. We've got a huge refugee problem. We've got a potential escalation. It could spill out much further. Given a million refugees plus, I understand, the Arab League is opposing intervention. It supported it in Libya. Wouldn't you think that the Arab League would get engaged in some sort of facilitation of conflict resolution, given what could emerge if they don't?
Can I add something to what my colleague said before first?
Absolutely.
I agree with what he said, but there's also another issue here too. It may not be as prominent, but I think the Russians and the Chinese steadfast in their veto in regards to this intervention in Syria also relates to they themselves have domestic issues. Russia has Chechnya, and the Chinese have Tibet. And I think there's always a concern that, you know, if we have these conflicts going on domestically within a country, that it's going to set an agenda for intervention. And I don't think the Chinese or the Russians, you know, don't want any international intervention within their domestic disputes as well. And I know that the Russians were against initially with the intervention in Libya as well. So I think that's another issue to think of. I think the Arab League, from what I've studied about it, it's largely been not a dysfunctional organization, but it really has never accomplished a whole lot. Whenever the issues of, you know, the Palestinians come up, they don't really take care of it. So I think this, you know, the buck always kind of gets passed to the international scene. And I think, you know, the Saudis don't want to publicly state, at least from what I've read over the last few days, they don't publicly state about wanting intervention. And I think the U.S. provides them cover, because I think it allows the U.S. to it gives the Saudis credibility once the U.S. Intervenes. They don't have to worry about the fallout, because it's the Americans ultimately that are doing it. It's not them.
What I'd like to end with is looking at some of the expertise that, Chris Mani, you have in human rights. You've looked at this through the lens of the African cases, and you've been very critical about the international criminal court system, the international justice system. Can your research and expertise in the African regions apply to the conflicts and human rights violations in the Middle East, or are they just too different?
Yeah, just before I come to that, I'd just also mention on Libya, there's been an incredible amount of distrust at the Security Council driven by what happened in Libya. So the use of force authorized in Libya was to facilitate a no-fly zone. Now, of course, after the NATO forces had completely destroyed the entire Libyan Air Force, they continued to bomb Libya until regime change occurred. Now, that makes Russia and China extremely hesitant to go along with any resolution at the Security Council that would justify, that would allow force under any circumstances, because, of course, they feel now that that France, the UK, and the United States may elastically interpret such a resolution in order to justify continued force until they effect regime change, or until, as many observers speculate, they put the Assad regime in such a weak position that it is more willing to come to coming to the negotiating table and negotiating from a position of weakness, so that Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and its Western allies can negotiate a transitional government full of individuals more sympathetic to their interests. Many speculate that actually a total loss in the conflict, so a victory for the rebels is not necessarily in the Western interest. They're simply trying to tilt the balance of the conflict back against Assad so that they negotiate some kind of transitional regime from a position of strength rather than negotiate when Assad's forces are in the ascendancy in the conflict. Now, just returning to your point about the International Criminal Court, it can only assert jurisdiction over situations involving either nationals of a state that has signed up to the ICC or over crimes committed on the territory of a state that has signed up to the ICC. Where that is not the situation, such as in Syria, which has not signed up to the ICC, the Security Council has to authorize jurisdiction for the International Criminal Court over the crimes committed in Syria. So the ICC could have jurisdiction if it was provided jurisdiction by the Security Council. Now, that's not to say that if there's evidence that, say, for example, Jordanian nationals fighting alongside either the Assad regime or the rebels, if they have committed abuses and that information is either provided to a government that is willing to refer this, that is also a state party that is willing to refer the situation to the ICC, or is provided to the prosecutor, then the prosecutor of his own volition may begin investigating those crimes. But the prosecutor could not go ahead and investigate crimes, say, for example, committed by Syrian nationals in Syria or by Saudi nationals in Syria, for example. That has to be a national of a state that has signed up to the International Criminal Court. So, of course, those under investigation in Africa will say, well, this international criminal justice system is selective because, look, we've had 100,000 people killed in the conflict in Syria in over the past couple of years, and there's no international criminal justice occurring there. There's only international criminal justice occurring in the very weakest of states. And, of course, Libya fell into that category. There was a UN Security Council referral of the situation in Libya to the International Criminal Court, so they indicted Gaddafi. And that's one other element that Russia and China appears to be attempting to block, is that ICC referral of the situation in Syria, because they see that as kind of like the start of the standard playbook. You refer the situation in Syria, then you can label, once they're indicted, the leadership of the regime alleged war criminals. Then that lends weight to calls for bilateral sanctions through the Security Council, multilateral sanctions through the Security Council, and then that leads to calls for the Security Council to authorize the use of force. So they don't want to start on the slippery slope, and that's why we're seeing the complete sidelining of international criminal justice in the case of Syria.
I want to thank the two of you for joining us, Eric Bordenkercher and Chris Mani. Thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
Chris Mani is the deputy director at the New Zealand Center for Human Rights, Law, Policy, and Practice, and on the Faculty of Law at Auckland University. He is the author of The Justice Sector Afterthought, Witness Protection in Africa, Pretoria, and the book chapter, Prioritizing International Sex Crimes Before the Special Court for Sierra Leone, Another Instrument of Political Manipulation. Eric Bordenkercher is a doctoral candidate in Islamic Studies at UCLA. His papers include Islamist in a Pluralist Society. When we come back, when to intervene, stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. The Syrian conflict has highlighted questions about intervention in violent conflict and human rights abuses. While the international community has been criticized for failing to protect some victims, such as those in the Rwandan genocide, it has also been criticized for intervening in others, including the Bosnian War. When should the international community intervene in a violent conflict? What is its responsibility to the victims of human rights violations? And what are the laws that govern foreign intervention? What about the laws in the U.S. governing its own intervention? Three experts are with us now. Frank Chalk is a professor of history and the director of the Montreal Institute for Genocide and Human Rights Studies at Concordia University. He is the co-author of The History and Sociology of Genocide, Analyses and Case Studies, and Mobilizing the Will to Intervene, Leadership to Prevent Mass Atrocities, together with General Romeo Dallaire. Karima Benoun is professor of law at University of California Davis School of Law. She's the author of Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, Untold Stories from the Fight Against Muslim Fundamentalism, and a contributing author to All Necessary Measures, Reconciling International Legal Regimes, Governing Peace and Security, and the Protection of Persons in the Realm of Counterterrorism. Ryan Henderson also joins us. Ryan Henderson is professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. He is the author of The Clinton Wars, The Constitution, Congress, and War Powers, and Diplomacy and War at NATO, the Secretary General and Military Action After the Cold War. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you for being with us on the Scholar Circle. I wanted to start with Frank Chalk. You are generally thought of as a strong interventionist. Given your research, if you look at a situation like Syria, where do you stand on intervention? How should the international community respond?
I'm not a knee-jerk interventionist. In other words, I think we all have to recognize the nuances of intervention and mistakes that have been made in the past. The responsibility to protect doctrine, which underlies our Mobilizing the Will to Intervene project, is full of what we call the precautionary principle, which is basically translating medicine's Hippocratic Oath into public policy. And it says, essentially, if you're going to do more harm than good, don't intervene. In the case, Syria is a real challenge for us. This is a case where at least two nuclear powers, China and Russia, have placed Syria under their protection in one form or another, certainly by threatening to use their veto in the Security Council. So UN authorization is very difficult to get for any kind of intervention. And I think boots on the ground are clearly very constrained by the record of the interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, although Libya offers a different model. But even Libya was a challenge for many members of the United Nations, like Brazil, that regarded the intervention as non-consultative. So you asked me a simple question, where do I stand on intervention in Syria? I really do favor negotiations as far as possible. And I think that President Obama said it very well the other day when he said, look, we wouldn't even have an offer from Syria to put its chemical weapons under international inspection had it not been for the threat of force, because they even denied they had them. And that's absolutely correct. So I think the credible threat of force, and in this case, a cruise missile attack against chemical weapons and command and control centers for chemical weapons is definitely on the table and a possibility. And I would support it. And I would also support going to the International Criminal Court and indicting all those members of the Syrian political elite who are attached to the decision to use chemical weapons. I do not favor armed intervention with troops on the ground. Under changing circumstances, if the inspection plan is dead in the water after a while, I think I would still support the idea of attacking the chemical weapons wherever they could be safely attacked.
Your partner in the Will to Intervene project, Senator Romeo Dallaire, has essentially called the global community right now inept in resolving and preventing conflict. Do you have a sense of what needs to be done to address the inadequacies that he's talking about?
Yes. General Dallaire pointed to the failures of the Rwanda operation by the United Nations, and the refusal of the great powers to tolerate a meaningful boots-on-the-ground intervention force, and running the moment that there was any sign of danger or resistance to the forces' will. And we both feel very strongly that the will to intervene requires capacity building and the creation of responsibility to protect nodes in the major governments that are interested in preventing mass atrocities. I think our bottom line is that we only favor intervention under international sanction and with international approval. And if we can't get it from the Security Council and the United Nations, then we have to get it from regional organizations and other international institutions, not only NATO, but other groups as well in the case of Syria. So that would include some of the Arab regional organizations. Then that intervention has to be proportional to the mass atrocities it's responding to. It has to be not necessarily aimed at regime change, although often that's necessary, but certainly aimed at protecting civilians who are under threat from their own government. And that also points to the fact that we're really in the very early days of learning how to locate effective and well-intentioned or at least cooperative local allies who will not simply use their opportunity to run the country as another way, another means of looting it or driving it down the path to another extreme ideology. This is an area which I'm sure my colleagues on the panel would like to talk about, because if you intervene and you don't really have a roadmap of any meaningful sort, you don't really have an idea of who you can work with on the ground and some kind of reliable ally on the ground, you're in big trouble. The local regional groups have a major role to play in dealing with their neighbors' offenses. And I just want to conclude this remark by saying that I think it's vital that we find local allies on the ground before we ever seriously consider a more forceful presence in a country like Syria. People that we can trust, people who can handle authority when they achieve it, and people who will work seriously and diligently to improve the welfare of their own people rather than use this opportunity in authority to loot the country or to drive some extreme ideology.
And it seems like the local organization, the Arab League in particular, has been opposed to intervention. Karima Bannoun, you've been looking at the international legal structures and in particular some of the conflicts and the legal regimes related to these issues of humanitarian law. What parameters and guidelines should we be looking at, and where are the conflicts that need to be resolved?
Thank you very much for inviting me to participate in this important discussion. So I think the most important backdrop for our discussion, legally speaking, is the UN Charter and the rules on the use of force in international law that are contained in the UN Charter. Now, the sort of the primordial norm is Article 2.4 of the UN Charter, which prohibits most uses of force, not all, but most. And there are really only two accepted exceptions to that norm in Article 2.4 of the UN Charter, and those two exceptions are, number one, the use of force in self-defense in accordance with international law under Article 51 of the Charter, or the use of force explicitly authorized by the Security Council acting under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. So basically, we find ourselves at the moment in neither of the two exceptions categories, because I don't think any of the sort of states internationally, the U.S., the U.K., France, that have talked about potentially using force here are in a self-defense situation. And clearly, we do not have the explicit authorization of the Security Council. And in fact, my understanding is this week that Russia is very strongly objecting to any Security Council resolution being adopted under Chapter 7 precisely because they seek to avoid any possibility that any such resolution could be used as the justification for the use of force. We then simultaneously have the emergence, arguably, of a norm of perhaps customary international law allowing for what used to be called humanitarian intervention, so the use of force to protect human rights. This debate shifted a bit, and we started to talk in 2001 about the responsibility to protect. It even has its own acronym, R2P. And I think there is a strong argument that the responsibility to protect represents sort of the a norm of customary international law that's beginning to crystallize, but it still does not override the black letter law which we find in the UN Charter. So we then, I think, face a situation in which, absent Security Council authorization, we essentially have to have a debate about whether or not an unlawful use of force in intervening would be an appropriate course of action.
Some scholars and practitioners both have been concerned about how international justice can be politicized in the decision to intervene or not. Perhaps in particular on the UN Security Council, different countries shield their friend states in one form or another. How do we deal with this?
You know, this is a very important question that you have identified. So the Security Council is the most important body in the world charged with the preservation of international peace and security. And the question then becomes, what do we do when the Security Council fails? Or what do we do when the Security Council is blocked from acting because of the potential vetoes of several of the permanent members or even just one of the permanent members? Now, the responsibility to protect itself is a doctrine that is really based on the responsibility of the international community to act through the Security Council. Even that doctrine doesn't really provide us, I think, with a deus ex machina, a device that gets you around the Security Council. And therein, I think, lies a very big challenge for the international community going forward. But to my mind, looking at this as an international lawyer and looking at this as a human rights lawyer, what's most important is not just the formalistic legal discussion, but also a discussion about what we can actually do that will have a concrete impact on improving the humanitarian and human rights situation on the ground. And I'm not sure we have yet heard the case about how force could be used at the moment to do that in the sorts of limited ways that have been discussed. Now, clearly, the use of chemical weapons is a very, very serious matter and should be taken very seriously by the international community. But we're talking about 1,300 to 1,400 people who were killed in a couple of hours. And there is the broader pattern, of course, of 100,000 Syrians who have been killed in the last 3 years. So I think we need to look at the issue of chemical weapons, and I'm glad that there is this move for Syria to accede to the Chemical Weapons Convention and to push for a verification regime. But we also need to consider the broader use of the overall humanitarian situation in Syria, which is threatened both by the crimes against humanity, which, as Ban Ki-moon said today, have been committed by the Syrian authorities, the Syrian state, but also by some of the very serious crimes that have been committed by some of the rebel groups. And I think any plan to use force needs to explain sort of how it will assist in all of those regards. And I think any use of force would have to be accompanied by serious negotiations, ongoing negotiations as well. Those things are not alternatives. They are complements.
I would like to go back to exactly what you're saying and talk about the various ways that something could be accomplished for the human rights violation purposes. But I want to, for a bit, turn to the United States situation with Ryan Hendrickson. You specialize in the U.S.'s legal structure for war powers or intervention. There's, as you've described in your work, the way that constitutional law is supposed to govern military intervention war powers, but there's also the evolution of the way it actually has been working over the past few decades. Let's start with the law and how it might apply in situations like Syria. The Constitution spells it out in a certain way. How it is written, and then how it's evolved.
Well, thank you for having me. So in terms of the constitutional separation of powers, I mean, the idea is that Congress is the branch that is going to check the commander-in-chief, When the Constitution was written, the idea was that the commander-in-chief would manage wars and oversee wars, but it would be the Congress that would be the branch that would not allow one man to take us to war. That's why Congress was given the power to declare war. For much of the 19th century, and even up to World War II, we have many instances, actually, of Congress voting to authorize a use of force. You know, only five declarations specifically of war, but Congress was involved in these decisions about whether or not to use force in other cases. But the evolution since World War II has really favored a very strong president. And that's because as the Cold War took off, beginning in, say, 1947 or so, the president became increasingly powerful. And Americans accepted the idea that the communists were a threat to the United States. And if there's a broad consensus on that, which there was, the political incentives for checking the president decreased substantially. So Congress, over time, really has become deferential to the commander-in-chief. So this is what makes, to bring us up to speed here, what made President Obama's decision to turn to Congress so fascinating. In previous uses of force, say our intervention into Panama in 1989 or our intervention into Grenada in 1983, presidents just went ahead and did that, and Congress largely accepted it. But this case was so different, and I think due to some of the points my colleagues made, there was such limited international support, and the UK Parliament voted no to use force. I think Obama felt sort of a necessity to help build some political backing somewhere. So he turned to Congress, and that's what in many ways makes this case so different.
You had studied the Libyan situation. What happened?
Well, the Libyan situation was very different here. As my colleagues noted, the relevance of international legal institutions was so much stronger. In this case, we had UN Security Council approval. We had NATO's approval and the Arab League's approval, at least for some engagement. So those votes and those political processes that were went through in those international institutions really helped Obama at least make an international legal case for using force. He went ahead and used force, and then most members of Congress went along and backed him. This case is different, I think, because we have so much international opposition.
Meaning that because you've got Russia and China on the other side, and they weren't blocking it in the Libyan case, that poses a whole new complication.
That's right.
Okay.
And then we had so much stronger NATO support in 2011. Not that all the members of NATO were willing to use force, but at least they were willing to allow the institution to use force. And then there was Arab League support. And that's what the absence of political support and diplomatic support for use of force is so limited in this case, which is what makes this case different, and which also has then impacted the debate in the United States. You see many members of Congress saying, look, we have very few international allies. They've asked many questions, like Karima pointed to, you know, what's the end game here? What's going to happen if you use force? So there's so many more questions, it seems to me, involving this an unbelievably small strike, as Secretary of State John Kerry said.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the conflict in Syria. Let's talk about what could be potentially done here, given the lack of Arab League support, the lack of potential NATO support. Karima and Frank, let's turn this back to you. What are the options in a case like Syria, where the world is so divided? You've got, as Karima mentioned, 100,000 people killed in the last 3 years. I think we have about a million plus refugees now, too.
Yeah, the refugee flows are really quite frightening. And the conditions in Jordan and other countries are growing worse and worse as they receive more and more refugees. I think that there are two things here to keep our eyes on and to keep in mind. The first is that any sort of political settlement, and most people agree that that's going to be essential in this case, has to assure the Russians, particularly, who have a very significant naval presence, a naval base in Syria, their only serious base in the Mediterranean, that they are not going to lose their base, that no matter what happens in Syria, no matter who finally rules, their geopolitical interests will be respected. I don't know if most of your listeners are aware of it, but in fact, there was also another initiative or focus on Russia's oil interests in Europe launched by Saudi Arabia within the last 12 months or so, in which the head of Saudi intelligence went to Moscow, if I remember correctly, and offered billions of dollars to the Russians if they would stop supplying the Assad regime, and said that Saudi Arabia would not compete with the Russians in Europe as well. That was not a successful offer, but it shows that the Saudis, as they often do privately, really get it and understood Russia's geopolitical interest in preserving a semblance of influence in Syria to protect it what it perceives as its vital interest in the Mediterranean. The second thing I think we have to keep our eye on is the Kosovo precedent, which we haven't talked about yet. There was a case where the Russians strongly objected to any intervention that would prejudice Serbian interests as they existed in 1999. And still, NATO took the responsibility of intervening in Kosovo after it appeared that more and more massacres of Kosovars would take place under Serb auspices. The Russians waved their big stick, and then they retreated when NATO and particularly the United States showed its will to intervene. Since then, a lot of water has flowed under the bridge, and today that would be a much more difficult sort of precedent to implement. But there is the possibility, as in the case of Kosovo, of getting United Nations support retroactively, which is far from ideal. I think my colleagues would agree. But in some cases, it may be necessary. So let's just imagine a scenario briefly in which at the last moment, the Russians are urging the Syrians to put their chemical weapons under international control, and they're really serious about it because they don't want to prejudice their interests further in the region. But Assad says, no, my colleagues, my allies, the Alawites and others will be at risk if I do this, and I'm not going to do it. I refuse to sign on the dotted line. So now we would have a situation where the Russians wouldn't be happy with the Syrians, and at the same time, the United States would be called on to act. And under those circumstances, it might well be possible, with the threat of Russia and other countries ceasing their military equipment supplies for Assad, their resupply of ammunition and all sorts of other weaponry, the possibility of some kind of effective arms blockade to keep Iran and some elements in Lebanon from providing great assistance to Assad. There might be a real possibility of replacing Assad. And if that was to be done, then the Russians might actually permit a Security Council vote, and the Chinese might permit such a vote, as long as they were assured of a political solution that did not prejudice their geopolitical interests. And the other alternative to this would be that the Assad regime would go forward, and if it felt it was losing support from its key allies, it might itself seek to negotiate some sort of enclave state in northwestern Syria, back in the old Alawite region of Syria, where the Alawites actually had their own state until roughly 1927, between about 1920 and 1927, it would not be ideal, but you could have a compromise whereby the Assad circle agreed to retreat to the northwest with guarantees of some sort of access to energy and oil to keep itself going, and of course with its view, its ports on the Mediterranean. And then there would still probably be elements of civil war remaining behind in the rest of Syria. So these are, you know, options that have not been talked about a great deal. Many of the Syria specialists are strongly wedded to the idea that the Assad group would never commit itself to an enclave government and restrict itself and shrink its territory. And many of the Syrian experts also continue to deny that the Alawites are really in a conflict with the Sunnis. I am not a Syria specialist of that type, and I believe that there is a serious danger that when the Assad regime collapses, if it does, that the Alawites will be at great risk of mass atrocities because of what's happened in the recent past, and that we also have to be thinking about how we would protect the Alawites from the retribution of other Syrians.
Karima Banoon.
Well, I would certainly add to the last comment that one has to be very concerned about the Christian population of Syria, and I know there have been a great deal of fears expressed by people from within that population, some of whom, and I have to stress some of whom appear to support the current regime, at least conditionally, because they're so frightened of what might happen to them if the regime fell, not necessarily because they actually like the government. So I do think that it's critical to think about the aftermath of a sort of regime change or an overthrow of the regime internally or externally. The current regime is clearly completely unacceptable on human rights grounds. I want to be clear about that. But there are also possibilities which are even worse. And, you know, there are some parts of the Syrian opposition which are secular, which appear to be relatively moderate. Certainly the early phase of the revolution in Syria, or the uprising in Syria, was a very peaceful one. But that has really shifted, and we've seen that al-Qaeda has moved in as it moves in and takes advantage of any situations of instability in the region. Al-Qaeda has moved in and is active and has allied armed groups which are active on part of the territory of Syria. It certainly doesn't represent the bulk of the opposition, but it is present and already committing grave abuses. There was a report on Reuters today about killings in front of school children by one of these al-Qaeda allied groups. So I've just completed a big three-year project about people of Muslim heritage standing up to the fundamentalists, and one of the things that I really looked at was people who had been opponents of past regimes, say in Egypt or in Tunisia, then having to sort of continue their work simply when the governments changed and begin to oppose the rise of theocracy. And certainly that's not a better alternative for Syria, and many people on the ground are very worried about that. I think that means we have to think very carefully about arming the rebels. Now, I don't rule that out entirely, and some people that I respect support doing that at least selectively. But I think we do have to remember what happened in Afghanistan back in the 80s when we supported the Mujahideen against the Soviet invasion, and we supported some of the most extreme Mujahideen groups, including Hizbi Islami, that was headed by Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. And that is something, you know, for which some Afghans still hold us very responsible. One of the women I interviewed for my book, Horia Mossadegh, who, you know, lost family during that time, talked about the role of the United States in supporting the Mujahideen, which we did in the context of sort of our conflict with the Soviet Union. But that came back to have unintended consequences, certainly for the civilian population on the ground. So I think we need to think long-term, not just about short-term solutions. We need to prioritize the interests of the Syrian population and not just our own interests. I understand that any country thinks about its interests when it acts, but we really have to focus on what's best for the civilian population and the entire civilian population on the ground. And I think we have to be very careful of regional consequences. We were discussing the Libya intervention. Well, in some ways, the overthrow of Gaddafi has been quite good for some Libyans and enabled the exercise of certain rights much more than had been possible under the Gaddafi regime, perhaps freedom of expression in particular, so that you can actually see public protests now in Libya. And yet, at the same time, there is reason to be very concerned about the weaponization of Libya now because of that intervention. There are weapons everywhere. The sort of ongoing role of former rebels who have refused to give up their arms and the transboundary effects. So we've seen effects of armed men moving into Niger, moving into Tunisia, some effects across the border in Algeria as well, and a great deal of resentment in the region about the intervention because of that. So again, I think the record there is a mixed one, and we need to think very carefully about the regional consequences. But really, at the end of the day, the most important factor has to be the human rights of the Syrian population, finding something effective to do about that, even if it's creative. So for example, one of the suggestions that I've seen, and I'm not entirely convinced by this, but I think it's interesting to consider, one of the suggestions I've seen is a real push to get serious negotiations going between President Obama and the new, should I say, more moderate president of Iran, President Rouhani, who says that he wants a new kind of relationship with the West, and trying to use that track of negotiations as well to open up new possibilities here.
Ryan Hendrickson, let's look at modern U.S. history in terms of intervention, particularly human rights and humanitarian interventions. Are there some that you can think of that we can learn from that will give us some basis for when the U.S. has done an intervention successfully, perhaps we should add, that we can draw from now that might apply to the Syrian situation?
Well, I have a couple points that, in response to my colleagues that relate to this question also. First, I'm not ruling out the possibility of a unilateral strike. I don't rule that out necessarily because it's good or bad, but I think the politics of this next stage are so difficult. I think negotiating with the Russians is going to be extremely difficult. I'm very very pessimistic about the prospects of any meaningful resolution out of the UN Security Council. And I'm a strong supporter of NATO, but I don't see NATO stepping in and making a meaningful decision on this either, even though the UN, the NATO Secretary General, Fogh Rasmussen, is pushing aggressively for a use of force, or he was. But I'm not optimistic about that. I think the Kosovo model, I think, is the closest thing, though, that I can that we could maybe say might be a successful humanitarian operation. The problem there, in comparing it to an intervention here in this case, is that NATO was supportive of it, and even many members of the UN were supportive of it. In fact, there was a UN Security Council resolution that didn't give authorization to use force, but broadly interpreted by, at that time, NATO Secretary General Javier Solana. Solana used the UN and used statements by Kofi Annan and others to build support in NATO. And in that way, you had a multilateral coalition that supported American intervention that was really framed around human rights. So it seems to me that helped the situation in Kosovo, helped remove Milosevic later on down the line. But even that's not the best comparison, but that's about as good as we have for a successful humanitarian operation, at least in modern times.
I think the Brazilian letter to the members of the General Assembly, et cetera, phrased it well when it called for responsibility while intervening, as well as responsibility to protect enforcement. And responsibility while intervening requires, as Ryan said, multilateral support, organizational, institutional support, whether it's NATO or some other group of coalition of the willing. in order to serve as a check and balance against any sort of imperial designs. And clearly the issue here is one of legitimacy. I think that Karima put it very well when she said our first priority should be the interests of the Syrian people. Clearly, the difficulty we're having is in finding a core group of Syrians who seem to be oriented towards protecting the welfare of the entire Syrian people. It's in the nature of civil wars that it's difficult to find such agents or such actors. The search has to go on, and I think it has to be done prudently, and it has to be done with serious attention to the notion of bearing the responsibility after the initial intervention, whatever it might be, for the consequences of that intervention.
This is Karima Banoon. The first is that I wanted to suggest that if people are interested in further information about this discussion, they take a look at a wonderful collection of articles called R2P and the Human Rights Crisis in Syria that has recently been posted on a website called Open Democracy, and they'll see further debate from all points of view about these very questions. And the second and last thing that I wanted to say is I think what we have to be very careful of is a debate in the global community or in our own country that is framed around two choices, using force and doing nothing. And I really fear that, you know, when this immediate debate about using force or not recedes, we'll sort of go back to the default option of, you know, not doing very much. And I think it's absolutely important, as we've all been saying, to look at the range of alternatives and to understand that the status quo in Syria is untenable, and the international community really does have a responsibility to act.
Thank you to the three of you, Frank Chalk, Karima Banoon, and Ryan Hendrickson. Really appreciate your research and your wisdom. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for giving us this opportunity, Maria.
Frank Chalk is a professor of history and the director of the Montreal Institute for Genocide and Human Rights Studies at Concordia University. He is the co-author of The History and Sociology of Genocide, Analyses and Case Studies, and Mobilizing the Will to Intervene, Leadership to Prevent Mass Atrocities, together with General Romeo Dallaire. Karima Banoon is professor of law at University of California Davis School of Law. She's the author of Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, Untold Stories from the Fight Against Muslim Fundamentalism, and a contributing author to All Necessary Measures, Reconciling International Legal Regimes, Governing Peace and Security, and the Protection of Persons in the Realm of Counterterrorism. Ryan Hendrickson is professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. He is the author of The Clinton Wars, The Constitution, Congress, and War Powers, and Diplomacy and War at NATO, The Secretary General and Military Action After the Cold War. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @armudian.